Glad Kevin selected that song about a love story, because tonight we're going to look at three love stories from the book of Ruth, and it culminates in the great love story. We know the Bible tells us that God is love, 1 John 4:8 and verse 16. And that statement is, it almost seems insufficient to me to say that God is loving. Loving is an adjective that describes God. But with the sentence that says God is love, that to me just has so much more strength. It's like the one verse, I believe in Colossians, it says that Christ, who is our life. It's not just that our lives are about Christ. For the faithful Christian, our life is Christ. And that just adds so much more strength to it. The Bible is, or it does contain, beautiful stories of love. And with the exception of what Jesus did for mankind, this book of Ruth contains greater love stories than even the Hallmark Channel can devise. Not that I've watched them. And when I have, it's been under duress. But I just want to go through the book of Ruth this evening, and I'm not going to read the entire text, obviously, although we probably could. It's four chapters. It's barely three pages in my Bible. But I just want to remind you of the incidents in the book of Ruth, and then try to draw out the love that we see in this book, and the types of love that we see. And so, when we look at the first love story I want to look at in the book of Ruth, is the love between Naomi and Ruth. And they are the, according to a lot of folks who, and we're talking about some tongue-in-cheek jokes about mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law, or fathers-in-law and sons-in-law. That's historically been fodder for jokes and contention, and maybe, you know, some good-natured ribbing, but, you know, it arises out of a lot of times that there is real strife between parents-in-law and their children-in-law. And that can be an unfortunate thing, but it's very real. But it's not the case here. So let's just remind you of the setting. I know the book of Ruth is in the Bible after the book of Judges, but the things that happen in the narrative of the book of Ruth happen during the time of the Judges. I'm not sure exactly what year, but we know that it was during the time that the Judges ruled, as verse 1 tells us. And it tells us that there was a famine in Canaan, specifically in Bethlehem of Judea. And this man takes his family and goes probably across the Jordan River and down the other side of the Dead Sea to the land of Moab. Moab was southeast of Judah. So this man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And so this man takes his wife and his two sons, and they leave Bethlehem, also called Ephratah in this narrative, and they go south to Moab because there's food there. Well, while they are down there, Elimelech dies, Naomi's husband. And then somewhere around this time, her two sons, they find wives in Moab. Chilion marries a woman named Orpah, and Mahlon marries a Moabitess named Ruth. And then to add tragedy upon tragedy, while they are still in Moab, Naomi's two sons die. And so now here are three widows living together. And widows were the poorest of the poor in Bible times. They had no man to go out and work to do the hard physical labor. And so they were reduced many times to begging. And so in verse 6, Naomi learns somehow that there are things, things are better back up in Palestine, where she's from. And so she determines to leave the foreign country with all of its idolatry and paganism, and to go back home where things are more comfortable. There's nothing like going home, whether you've been out at work all day or whether you've been on vacation for a week. There's just something pleasant and nice, generally, about going home. That's one of the mother and home are two of the loveliest words we have in our language. There's just nothing like going home. And so she decides to go home. And it seems that her daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, accompany her for a while. But then at some point, Naomi urges them to turn back, to stay in Moab. Naomi says in verse 8 to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house." And then she prescribes a blessing upon them. "Jehovah deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So Naomi is giving these two young widows an opportunity to go and find new husbands, because they're still young enough. They are still, you know, vital in that regard. They can still produce offspring, basically, is the intent here. You know, they've still got time to have children and raise families. And she kissed them. But they both lifted up their voices and wept in verse 9. And then in verse 10 it says, "And they said to her, 'Surely we will return with you to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Turn back, my daughters. Why would you cling to me? I don't have anything more to offer you. You had my sons. Unfortunately, they died.'" And she says, "I don't have any more sons to give you. And even if I were to get a husband tonight, would you wait for my sons to grow up to where you could marry them?" She says, "No, my daughters. You go find husbands." So in that sense, you know, they are both expressing this loyalty to their mother-in-law. But Naomi says, "I'm releasing you from that." And they lifted up their voices in verse 14 and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Ruth is determined not to leave her. And Naomi says to her in verse 15, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Now we might question Naomi's thinking here with respect to at least one thing. Naomi was a worshiper of the true God, Jehovah. Why does she encourage her daughters-in-law to go back and serve pagan gods? That seems out of character for a child of God, doesn't it? Couple possibilities. The most likely of which was, Naomi's not perfect. Okay? She's a godly woman, but she's not a sinless woman. She's not a perfect woman. And perhaps this is just an instance of a godly person not thinking clearly and suggesting something that is opposed to God. And granted, we don't have any word of censure regarding Naomi in this regard. And this is not the only time Naomi's going to do something that we might question. But how many times have we done something and didn't really think about it until somebody pointed it out to us? It's like, what was I thinking? There's one thing I've pondered a lot, being someone who professes to be somewhat of a musician and a singer. And this is true especially in country music and especially in bluegrass. Sometimes somebody's writing a song, and so they've got these words and they've got a melody, but they need something to fill a gap. They need a word to fill a space in a song. And invariably, they use the word Lord. And they're not talking about the Lord in the song, and they're certainly not talking to the Lord in song, but they just use the word as a conjunction to connect one phrase to another phrase. And so I was singing these songs, and I was putting the Lord, Lords in there. You hear it a lot in especially old blues and early country songs. You'll hear it a lot. And it dawned on me one day. I was going down the road driving and just listening to the, I had a cassette tape at the time. And I was listening to the song, and I'm thinking about things. And there was this song that was on. It was Flat and Scruggs Doing My Time. And at the end of every line, there was the phrase, Lord, Lord. And the song had nothing to do with anything religious. It's about a guy who was in prison doing time. But like the old guys that would moan the blues, it was all, Lord, Lord, I'm, you know. And I'm thinking all of a sudden, I said, I got to quit doing this. I said, that's a vain use of the Lord's name. And so I have learned that if I do sing these songs, I don't say Lord, Lord. I'll say old boys or poor boys or something, but I won't use the Lord's name in vain because it violates my conscience. But that, and I said all that to say this. Here is an example of somebody who is suggesting to somebody else, you need to go back to your family and to your pagan gods. Why would a child of God encourage somebody to go back to their pagan gods? I think it was just a thoughtless gesture on Naomi's part. But look what Ruth says. Ruth doesn't have this salty relationship with her mother-in-law like Hollywood likes to, you know, it's the gist of some of our sitcoms and different things. Ruth says to her, which our brother read for it a moment ago, but she says, entreat or do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. I want to go where you go. I want to live where you live. I want your God to be my God. I want your people to be my people. And where you die, that's where I want to die. And there will I be buried. And then she puts a little bit of an oath on herself. She says, Jehovah, do so to me and more. If anything but death separates us. That's love. That's devotion. And this for a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law. It's one of the greatest statements of commitment that we find in Holy Writ. And it shows us that love is sacrificial. When you love somebody, you will sacrifice yourself, your desires, your wants for theirs. That's why this is such a beautiful love story. And this is the kind of commitment we need between spouses, between brothers and sisters in Christ. And more importantly, this is the kind of commitment Christians need to God. Right here, two verses. But if we have this kind of commitment to God and to Christ and to the Holy Spirit, then the rest of this is going to come so easy. It will not be a burden to us. It will not seem drudgery. It will not seem that God's commandments are grievous unto us. If every Christian adopts this as their pledge of allegiance to God, we'll see fewer Christians leaving the church. We'll see fewer churches splitting and dividing. We won't see much of this bickering sometimes that we see between brethren. We'll see the divorce rate plummet. And this nation will be a better nation. And this world will be a better world. If we would adopt these two verses as our commitment to God, to our spouses, parents to children, children to parents. We need this kind of commitment. So Naomi realizes she's not going to dissuade Ruth from staying with her. So she stops talking about it. And they travel until they come to Bethlehem. And they enter the city, and the news travels that Naomi's back. And everybody's excited to see her. Don't know how long she was in Moab. She was evidently a popular person, somebody that was well liked. And the news spread that they were back. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" And they're happy to see her, but Naomi doesn't share their joy. "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara." Naomi means pleasant. Mara means bitter. She says that the Almighty has dealt with me very bitterly. That's another thing that we might question Naomi. It seems that Naomi holds God responsible for her misery, for losing her husband, for losing her sons, for having to flee her country because of a famine. She says in verse 21, "I went out full, and Jehovah has brought me home again empty." Job uttered something very similar to this. I forget the book, chapter, and verse. But Job said something to the effect that the Almighty has dealt with me very bitterly, or in a bitter fashion. The Almighty, that's the Hebrew word El Shaddai. I think it's a beautiful sounding name, El Shaddai. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Now, Naomi has her husband was a man who had a relative who had great wealth. Elimelech's relative, his name was Boaz. And so Ruth, again, they're still widows. They still don't have a man in their life. who is going to provide for them. So Ruth takes it upon herself. She's the younger of the two, we assume. And she takes it upon herself to go get grain. She's going to go work in the field. She's going to go glean. Gleaning was a practice in Old Testament times where, the reapers would go through the fields and they wouldn't get every piece of fruit off the vine. They wouldn't get every ear of grain. And so the gleaners would come through after the reapers and they would pick up what the reapers missed. And in fact, they were instructed there were certain laws in the Old Covenant with respect to gleaning. In Leviticus 23 and verse 22, it says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field when you reap. Nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger." You know, most fields are square or rectangular in shape. And so they kind of, the reapers would go in kind of a circular motion. So, and they would leave the corners. And so she goes and gleans. In verse 3 of chapter 2, the Bible says, "Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened," underline the word happened, "she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech." That word there, where it says she happened, in my margin, I have a little P. And it's circled. And for me, I know that means providence. This is a providential orchestrating of God. Very similar to the verse in Esther chapter 4 about verse 14 when Mordecai tells Esther, "Who knows if not perhaps you were here for such a purpose?" So Boaz comes from Bethlehem, and he says to the reapers, "Who is this woman who is gleaning in my fields?" And they said, "This is the young Moabite woman that came back with Naomi." And Boaz is intrigued. The worker tells Boaz, "You know, she came wanting to glean in the field. We told her, go ahead." And Boaz says to Ruth, "I want you to listen to me," verse 8. "I don't want you to go to anybody else's fields. When you decide you need to come and glean, I want you to come to my field. Stay close to my reapers, my women. And if when you get thirsty, you come to the water that my laborers have drawn." Boaz is, the old timers called it, Twitter-pated. He's infatuated. He thinks she's pretty. And he's also heard how kind she has been to Naomi. She falls on her face and bows to the ground and says, "Why have I found favor in your eyes since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered in verse 11, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before." He admires her for her loyalty, for her love, for her mother-in-law. So Boaz says to her at mealtime, "Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." And she sat beside the reapers and he passed parched grain to her and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back. And then she rose to glean again. And Boaz commanded his young men saying, "I want you to let grain fall let her glean even among the sheaves. Let her glean among the parts of the crop that hasn't even been reaped yet. In other words, let her go in front of the reapers. And then he says, I want you to let some of your barley fall out on the ground so she can pick it up. He's trying to entreat himself to her. She takes it and she goes back to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And Naomi tells her all about Boaz. Verse 22, Naomi says to Ruth, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women and that the people do not meet you in any other field. So she stayed close to the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. So Naomi knows the custom. She's going to fix it up. So Ruth and Boaz get married, and she begins to tell Boaz, he's been showing his affection for Ruth, but he doesn't want to press the courtship, I think, because we gather that Boaz is much older than Ruth. And I gather that from chapter 3, verse 10, when Boaz says, blessed are you of Jehovah, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether rich or poor. So that implies to me that Boaz is older, perhaps a good bit older. But Naomi knows the customs of the time and the land. There were courtship rituals in Israel, and no doubt there were courtship rituals in Moab, but they probably weren't alike. Okay? There were different courtship rituals. Unfortunately, today, in about every land, it seems like anything goes. But there were courtship rituals. And so Naomi is going to tell Ruth how to let Boaz know that she is willing to receive his affection. She says in verse 3 of chapter 3, I want you to go wash yourself and anoint yourself. Put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down that you notice the place where he lies, and you go in and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And all that she said to her, she said to her, all that you say to me I will do. So Ruth's going to do this. And so after Boaz had eaten and drank and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain at the threshing floor, and she came and softly uncovered his feet and lay down. And so it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there's a woman lying at his feet. And he says, who are you? And she says, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. The close relative. We don't understand this in our culture, but that close relative meant something very significant. A close relative was also a redeemer. So if, let's just look at Leviticus 25 for a minute. Leviticus 25:25. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possessions, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. So if you sold yourself into slavery, a near relative could come and redeem you. Boaz and Elimelech were near relatives. That's what we have to keep in mind. Keep remembering that. So the law gave the nearest relative the right to redeem the property of the deceased. Okay. And with the right of the property also came the responsibility of raising children to the name of the deceased man. And so you recall one of the parables of Jesus. The Sadducees came and said, Okay, we had this fellow died, leaving no children, and then his brother married his wife, and he died with no children, then another brother, and then seven had her. Okay, what that was talking about was the Levirate marriage law, which said that if a brother or a man dies, leaving no offspring, then his brother was obligated to take his wife and raise offspring to the name of the brother. And that's what's happening here. Okay. Boaz wants to marry Ruth. And it seems that Ruth would be agreeable to this. But there's a problem. There is another relative standing in Boaz's way. We'll get to that in a second. So, Ruth is in the threshing floor at Boaz's feet. And Boaz is encouraged by this. And Naomi is confident that things are going to work out. We see in chapter 3, verse 18, she said to Naomi, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. For the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day." So Ruth goes, and this custom of uncovering the feet and laying there and cover me with your wing, there's a lot of debate and a lot of supposition about what actually happened, what went on. Bottom line is this: whatever Ruth did, Boaz knows that she would be receptive to his proposal of marriage, okay? And there have been all kinds of wild, fancy speculation as to what all these things meant, and I'm not even going to come close to getting into that this evening because that's not part of the story. So here's the thing. Boaz, chapter 4, verse 1, he goes up to the city gate and he sits down there. This is where everybody goes and talks and shares business and announces things. And so the other relative comes. And Boaz says, "I want you to sit down here for a minute." So this other relative, he comes there and he sits down by the gate. And Boaz gets 10 men of the city, 10 witnesses, to establish every word. You know, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be. Okay, he's got 10. He doesn't want any chance of this going south. And then he said in verse 3 to the close relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of these inhabitants and the elders of my people. And if you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, then let me know that I may know, or then tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you." And so the guy says, "I'll redeem it. I want that land." And then Boaz springs the trap. "Okay, but on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance." So he says, "Well, if you take the land, you've also got to marry Ruth." And then the relative says, "Whoa, hold it. I don't want a ready-made family." The close relative says, "I can't redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance." May have been true, may have been just a way to get out of it. Verse 7, "Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was a confirmation in Israel. Therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal." The ceremony of the sandal. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, basically, this guy was refusing his right to redeem the land and Ruth. And since he was giving up his right, he gave his sandal to Boaz as a symbol of the deal. Today, you and I would shake hands. I don't know the significance of the sandal oath. I haven't researched it, but I know that the Bible says that's what it meant. And again, back in Deuteronomy 25, verse 9 and following, it goes through this. So Boaz worked it out to where he could marry the love of his life, Ruth. And they get married, and in verse 13, we find that a son is born. And Naomi takes the son and holds it to her bosom and becomes a nurse for the baby. And they live happily ever after, so far as I know. But there's a third love story that we see peppered throughout the book of Ruth. And it's probably less obvious than the love that Ruth had for Naomi and the love that Naomi and Boaz had. But it's the story of God's love for his people. Throughout the book, there are many references to the truth that God is in control, that God orchestrates his will. God accomplishes his will when it does not interfere with our freedom of choice. Okay? God's will is that everybody will be saved and go to heaven. But he is not going to cause us to violate our will or our conscience to do that. He wants us to learn about him. He wants us to make the choice to serve him. But God is not going to make us serve him. But yet God is in control. And again, I go back to chapter 2 and verse 13 or verse 3. When he left and went and gleaned in the fields of the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Why is that so important? Because Ruth is in the bloodline of Jesus Christ, King David. We'll get to that in a second. Again, we may dispute some of Naomi's theology. Again, she urged her daughters-in-law to go back to pagans. She seemingly blamed God or held God responsible for some of the bad things that happened in her life. But she was confident that things were going to work out. And we also, you know, wonder maybe why God preserves this story for us. And I think it stems from the fact, again, that God is love. And this is a beautiful story of love. And it's not just a fairy tale, but it shows us love, especially Ruth's speech to Naomi, where she said, you know, where you go, I'm going to go, and where your God will be my God, and your people my people. But I'm reminded of what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. Does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but it rejoices in truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. And then down in verse 13, the final verse of the chapter, it says, now abides faith, hope, and love. These three, but the greatest is love. And we learn that, or we see it illustrated anyway, in the account of Ruth and Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. You see, the book of Ruth shows God's love for Israel and his love for us. God loved Israel, and he loves us. But the reason Israel lost its blessings, the reason Israel lost its right to the land of Palestine, even to today, is because they rejected God. That's why there's turmoil in Palestine today. The book said to Israel that regardless of the times, God still will show you his love. And he was working in the lives of the people of Israel at that time. And again, the providence that we see there in chapter 2, verse 3. We see providence in Esther, chapter 4, verse 14. We see providence in the life of Joseph, especially, and so many other places. He was working through Israel here to give them a king. They were not going to accept God as king, so he was going to give them King David. And the book also speaks to us that regardless of the times, God will show his love to us as well. God shows his love for people in general. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, Jesus, who, if we trace his lineage back, we'll find David. And if you trace it on back from David, well, let's just look at the last paragraph of the book of Ruth. Verse 18, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon. Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. You think those lineages in the Bible are unimportant and boring to read? No, because they take us back. They take us from Christ, clear back to Adam in Luke's gospel. This story is in here because of the love that it shows for families, the love between a man and a woman, and the love between God and us. Ruth loved Naomi and vice versa. Boaz and Ruth loved each other, and God loves us. And one of the saddest things in the world is unrequited love, or love that is expressed by one and not returned by the other. God has expressed his love for us in the giving of Jesus Christ. We express our love to God by being obedient to Jesus Christ and returning that love, reciprocating that love. Jesus said in John 14, 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. Do you love Jesus? Have you obeyed Jesus? And are you still obeying Jesus? That's what happens when a Christian falls from grace. They stop obeying Jesus. Maybe tonight you have found yourself in a similar situation. Perhaps momentary weakness. But we want to help you. Obey the gospel or be restored to the fellowship of the saints. The song has been selected and we're going to sing it right now. Would you come and take a seat on the front row as we stand and sing?